It is the second 50-50 football show. Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons with you for this one. The way this is going to tend to work is it's not going to be quite as sort of room orientated and stretching out into the calls as the Thursday show, the preview show that looks ahead to the weekend. Instead, what we're going to be doing is getting some people on the phone, having a nice relaxed chat with them about what their side has been up to this weekend. We're going to be joined in a second, though, in the room by Sam Walkerdine, who spoke about Arsenal on Thursday with us. He's going to come in a second. We're going to have a chat about everything that's going on at Arsenal, not just the result against Liverpool, but the fact that the club really does seem a little shaky for the first time really in about 15 years properly at the moment. We're going to be speaking to him. We're also going to be speaking to Guito Clewellyn. He's going to be coming on to let us know about Swansea and their excellent escape this season from what was looking a pretty perilous situation. And we're also going to be joined by Daniel Gray, author of 3pm Football, 3pm Saturday, sorry, a fantastic book, and Middlesbrough supporter, and just has a possessor of a lovely voice. In fact, John, I would say this is probably our loveliest voice-based lineup between Sam, Guito and Dan.
It's very, very strong. Sam's silky smooth voice is well known. Obviously, Guito's got that just lovely, lovely Welsh lint. And Italian good looks, obviously. But I mean, I've got to warn you about Dan, though. I think he's a bit depressed.
Is he?
Yeah.
It's hard, Middlesbrough, at the moment.
Yeah, he said, I'll come on, but just to warn you, I hate football.
That's not unreasonable.
Which, as a man who's written a lot of football books, is quite the
omission. Yeah, we might have to talk about, I might just read his book back to him, about all the things he enjoys about
to
football.
To remind him.
Yeah, all the good stuff. So yeah, it's excellent to get everybody on. So we're going to start, though, with Sam, as he's joined us in the room. And Sam, I want to focus really on the Sanchez thing, first and foremost. It's a rare moment. It feels to me as though there's an entire thing that has backfired around Arsene Wenger on this at the weekend's game, not starting Sanchez, then having to bring him on at half-time. All the stuff around training ground bust-ups, the contract stuff, the idea that he annoys his teammates because he demands high standards. It all feels a little edgy all of a sudden, this.
Yes, it does, and it feels quite weird, actually, like you said at the beginning about how Arsenal seemed like a bit of a kind of shaky place for the first time in, you know, maybe 15, 20 years, and it feels a bit weird. It feels kind of strange to be seeing Wenger clearly under a lot of pressure, you know, and but what I found weird about the weekend is, first of all, it was kind of, there was a lot of discussion about why he left him out in the first place, you know. And since then, you know, we found out that there was some kind of row or whatever. But for me, it feels strange, like, either play him or don't, you know. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, either tell him off or don't.
Because what's happened now is it feels like the worst possible thing, where you've got, oh, we don't need you, and then it's, yes, we do. Yeah. It's almost kind of like begging your girlfriend to come back, isn't it? A little bit, really. And so either leave him out altogether or give him, you know, sort of last 15 or whatever. But to bring him on, it just sort of proves his point, doesn't it?
Exactly. And it's made him, it feels like he's kind of gone like, see, I told you, you know. And I don't know whether that maybe makes Wenger look a bit, not weak, perhaps, but... I don't know whether indecisive, perhaps. It's just, I feel like they should have just not played him. Like, I know that
not
feels
even
weird.
Not even Adam in the 18.
Yeah, kind of, right. Like, if there's a real problem enough to not play someone, then, you know, make a point of it. Like, you know, with the whole Ferguson thing, when someone was, you know, bad or whatever, you know, wrote something weird in a book at Manchester United, he's out. He's not out for a bit and then we'll bring you on at half time. He's gone. And it's like, as much as that feels weird to say, the idea of getting rid of clearly our best player.
Yeah.
You know, I think just one or the other.
I mean, after the game as well, he was asked about it and said it was a tactical thing. Mm. And since then, obviously, it's come out that there was a training ground bust up. And I don't know where these leaks come from, but it usually comes from the side who were worried about something and feel like they got to prove. So I would imagine it's come from someone within the club who wanted to say, well, actually, it was Sanchez's fault. But even that's kind of backfired because, I mean, I don't know, we all follow different people on Twitter and things like that, and you can look too much into the people you follow. But a lot of the journalists who I was seeing last night when the story broke from the Half-Ten Mafia were saying... taking the players' side, and that's almost unprecedented. So normally, you know, I mean, there seems to be that everyone's decided that players have too much power at the moment, and normally if a player's kind of behaving badly or kind of throwing his toys out the pram or there's anyone in discipline, generally speaking, especially journalists who are very sanctimonious, we'll side with the manager and we'll say, you know, oh, he's done that, he's exactly the right thing. But there seems to have been a general acceptance since the story's come out, and again, you might agree or disagree that, well, actually, what Arsenal needs is more people like Sanchez who are prepared to say, look, actually, this isn't right. This, you know, what's going on at Arsenal? You know, we should be doing much better than we are.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think a little bit of it is there's a way to do that, and I think from what I've read, it seemed like one of the things that was kind of a problem is that the way he's been acting. Yeah. Like, it's fair enough to say we should all try really, really hard and we need to give a lot more. But I think to kind of get in a mood and storm off a pitch and not, you know, clap your away fans and things like that, I'm not sure it's definitely the right way to approach it. I mean, I read something this morning that talked about how this has kind of been coming for a little while, you know, and when he got taken off at Norwich, I think it was last season or season before, that he went down the tunnel, got changed, and left the stadium. And a little bit of me starts to think about then Alexis Sanchez just walking into Norwich. You know what I mean? Yeah. He's on his own. You know, the coach is still obviously at the stadium because the ground's going on. He's just wandering about. And that's weird, isn't it?
It's very weird indeed. He's got a suit on. He's a man wanting a suit on a Saturday walking around Norwich.
And he's definitely got that weird little bag.
The wash bag,
and maybe the Beats on. You know?
And then a kid sees him, goes, that's a length, he's dancing, says, Dad's like, don't be stupid. He's literally playing football.
Yeah. I think to be serious though, it is really hard because I see Alexis working so much harder than everyone else and being so great and clearly wanting, he just wants to win. But then I look at Wenger and think, well, he does too.
Yeah.
You know?
But that's where it's been a funny side all season, for instance. I didn't understand why everyone had the reaction they had when it's funny, but you know, in the idea that the players being unreasonable, where the gif that went round of Oxlade-Chamberlain at Bayern Munich, where he goes and presses the ball. It's clearly the tactic is to go and close them down. He goes and closes them down, closes the next one down, closes the next one down, turns around, and no one else is bothered. And if you know, the first thing that we all know now because of how much is written about it, the key thing about pressing the ball is we've all got to do it, lads.
So
he does the ridiculously sort of petulant five-year-old thing, and it is funny. But my point on this is everyone's going, oh, doesn't he look an idiot there? I'm going, it's everyone else. No one else has gone to do that with him. He's been left to do it on his own. And that, watching Arsenal at the weekend, you know, it did feel like there's almost two teams going on, or there's something that's not quite as it should be. And you know, whether it's just in these tougher games where they just don't look like one set of footballers. They do almost look like they look like, like there's camps, if you know what I mean. Like Oxlade-Chamberlain saying, well, I'm working this hard, so everybody else should be. You get the same sort of impression from Sanchez. And then there's issues around other players who either just don't have that in them, which I think is the category that Ozil falls into, or who just aren't playing well, aren't performing as everyone needs.
Well, I touched on it a little bit on Thursday, and it was about that idea of how Wenger kind of leaves them to do that. You know, there's kind of basic instructions, you know, but he does give them a kind of license to do their thing to a degree. And I wonder whether, you know, Alexis is obviously, that's his thing, is to chase and harry and, you know, and press. And I think it kind of perhaps rubs off on some of the team, but perhaps not all of them. So if it's up to them, the players, to be like, actually, you know what, I'm going to do that. But the other ones are like, well, I haven't really been told I've got to do that.
Yeah.
So I might not. You know what I mean?
Yeah, We've sort of been here before in terms of, you know, Neil started the show by saying it feels strange, and I kind of agree and disagree with him in a way, really, because it feels like we do this kind of every season, and then Arsenal kind of pull out the bag. And I've noticed that this morning as well, there's the talk, well, you know, surely Tottenham have got to finish above them this season because they're playing so well and things like that, but we thought that last season and it didn't. Do you expect him to do what he always does and get top four, or do you just think, you know, it might be one hurdle too many?
I was thinking about that this morning, and someone actually came up to me this morning and said that they knew someone who works at Arsenal, blah, 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 and said that Wenger's actually already signed his new contract, but they're just too worried to say now, basically. It's just the wrong time to mention it. So I think, like, with that in mind, I think they will finish top four. Only because that's all I know. I don't understand anything else. So, I mean, it's weird, isn't it, how, like, quickly these things change. If I really hope that we get to the FA Cup semi-final, you know, and if that goes the right way, you know, we could end up in the cup final again, if not winning it. And suddenly that changes things. I mean, obviously, there's still the issue of the same things happening again and whether Wenger should stay or not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because he might come top four and still leave.
Yeah. But I don't know. I feel like they'll just do it because they know how to do it. And I'd like to think that maybe they'd do it for him.
Okay. Lovely to speak to Sam. We will shoot over now and we'll speak to Gito. Indeed, over to Gito to talk about the joy of last-minute winners, big goals, late in games, but also in general, Gito, you know, we've been through the Anfield Rap stuff, we've been talking now, this is now 50-50 football, obviously, but we've been talking now since October, and I feel like I've gone on this journey with you. The first time I spoke to you, you were pretty inconsolable, and then from that point, you were whatever was a notch beneath inconsolable, and then after that, I would say you were a man who had literally no hope, and suddenly it's 27 points. It looks, I mean, I'd be honest, I'd be stunned right now if Swansea ended up getting sucked back into this relegation battle. To me, I don't think there's room for complacency, but there's gaps, there's room, there's the fact that there's four sides who comfortably look worse. It's a good time all of a sudden.
It's incredible, if I'm honest, the transformation. It feels like I'm supporting a different team in 2017 to the one that I was supporting in 2016. And there's a good reason for that, is because we're playing like a completely different team. Everything that Paul Clement could have changed, he has, and it's all had a positive effect. And the Burnley win on Saturday was probably the most satisfying result of the season, because everything which could have gone against us did go against us. That we had an awful refereeing mistake.
It's one of the maddest penalties I've ever seen. I couldn't believe it when I saw it, because we got to the ground at Anfield early, and I thought, oh, it sounds like a great game, this Swansea Burnley one, a topsy turvy, but really, kind of Burnley weren't really in it. Where they just kind of got some, you know, they could score a nice second, but got some mad calls, but the penalty. I mean, surely a clue is the fact that the Swansea players all appear for handball. And I'm thinking, if you're not looking, it's a crowd. If you're not sure, I understand anything. Who's if you're Andy Taylor and you're looking for the clues, who's handballed it? Well, all the Swansea fans are appealing for players, all stand around appealing for the free kick. I mean, that should have given something away.
Yeah, and if you look at the Burnley fans as well behind the goal, you know, fans will appeal for absolutely anything, but none of them moved. You know, none of them moved when that ball hit Sam Vokes' arm, and you can see his reaction when the penalty is actually given. He's just pretty shocked and almost embarrassed, if I'm honest. It was an incredible decision, which nobody could understand at the time. And when you look back at the replays, it just makes no sense. And it came at a point when we were completely dominant. We were 1-0 up. We'd hit the woodwork twice, and we were completely bossing the game. And Burnley just didn't look interested. They just turned up to sit back and not even park the bus. They just didn't look like they knew really what they wanted from the game. And suddenly they get this, you know, this incredible bit of luck, which levels the score. But the Swans kept on going and kept on pushing, creating chances. And then in the 60th minute, out of nowhere, Andre Gray scores a very good goal. But that was really their only chance of, their only clear chance of the game, apart from the penalty. And you know, when you get that feeling when everything is going against you, nothing is quite going right, and you just think it's going to be one of those days. But, you know, they kept on going, kept doing what they've been doing all game, putting good deliveries into box, controlling possession and keeping the pressure up on Burnley. Olsen got a beautiful goal, and then in the final minute, Llorente with a brilliant header.
I love how he heads it, you know. I love that header was. I mean, you can have a little bit of a. He does give him a bit of a push in the back, but let's forget about that for a second here. Swansea were due a little bit of fortune, but it's such a. He headers the ball in a manner that's permanent. You know what I mean? He headers that into the net. It's unerring. It is as simple as soon as it leaves its head, it's a goal. It's very similar to the one he scores at Anfield, and that was a great header as well. There's certain footballers, and you know Andy Carroll's one, and some shorter players as well. It's not just about the size, but there's certain players who, when they head the ball, it's just so emphatic.
Yeah, I mean he puts the whole weight of his body behind that ball. He gets an incredible leap after running onto it, and Ben Mee, he's not the worst in the air, but he's got no chance. I know he gets a push, a little push in the back, but Llorente just said, "I'm having this one," and he just absolutely planted it into the back of the net. We've known that he's capable of that kind of header, but in the first half of the season, he wasn't getting those quality crosses that he's been getting. Recently, the only kind of quality he was getting was usually from set pieces and Gylfi Sigurdsson. Now, for the first goal, the cross is beautiful as well from Leroy Fair, who's been transformed into Paul Clement. And then for the third one, the winner, it's Tom Carroll, a man who I don't think many people were excited about when he signed for the Swans in January, but he's been an He's had an incredible impact on midfield. He's just completely different to the player that we thought we were buying. And that cross was stunning again and just put in the perfect area for him to attack. And when that ball hit the back of the net, the stadium just erupted.
And I wanted to talk to you about Leroy Fair. You mentioned him there before. It strikes me as I've seen him, and I think he's gone down twice now, But whenever I've seen him, I've always thought he looks. There's a footballer there, there's a top level footballer there, and he's always shown little things in patches in games. Is Clement getting him to sort of link all that up now, getting him to put in something approximating a 90-minute performance, using him the way in which is slightly odd sort of set of attributes, getting the most out of them.
He's finally found a position and a role for him in the team that works. I've always, even before he arrived at Swansea, I've always thought of Leroy Fair as a match of the day player. He'll pop up with the odd wonder strike every now and again, but his overall contribution to the team is poor. Doesn't really put the shift in, doesn't defend very well. But in fairness, now that Gylfi Sigurdsson's been moved out to the wing, he's picked up a slightly more advanced role in the side, and it's sort of as though without the when the Swans don't have the ball, he knows where to be and keeps that discipline far better than we ever saw before. But when we've got the ball as well, he's got a lot more freedom, and he's picking up good positions, and he looks far more. Far more enthusiastic now. He's enjoying physical battles. He actually looks like a sort of smaller version of Yaya Toure. When he gets on the ball, he's using his strength now, and he really does enjoy just running with the ball. And he can hold off players when they challenge him for the ball. But his end product too has improved massively. He's not scored since Paul Clement came in. Which is the one thing that he was doing earlier on in the season, but everything else he's doing is absolutely superb. And I've never been a fan of his. I've been extremely critical in the past, but I've got nothing but praise for the way that he's turned around his performances. He's a completely changed player.
Let's talk about the manager a little bit then, because I think like you have found that the change staggering, and what's been quite interesting to me is he's sort of the opposite of a manager you'd expect to get a bounce, if that kind of makes sense. So everyone, when people talk about a manager who's going to save your season and you're going to keep you up, it's not really guys like Paul Clement people talk about, or Sam Allardyce's and things, or guys who are just going to, get them coming in, get them working hard, get them pumped up a bit, It's that kind of fella. It's a Neil Warnock coming, isn't it? He's absolutely none of those things, Clement. He shows plenty of emotion when that final goal goes in, he's doing the run and the jump and things like that, which is good to see. But generally, when you hear him talk, when you hear him interviewed, he's very measured, he's not one to, for hyperbole. bowl or anything. He's just kind of a pretty straight guy, and you know, all his work's obviously on the coaching ground, and that's what he wants to do. He's obviously happiest, you know, working with players and things like that. So bearing that all that in mind, really, it's remarkable that the impact he's been able to have so quickly on so many of the different players, because as you say, a lot, you know, so many of them are just playing so much better than they were before.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He had such a huge challenge when he took over. The club needed a complete transformation, really, on the coaching side of things, and he's done that in an incredibly short space of time. He's clearly got them working harder. But more than anything, they just. Everything seems so much more meticulous. We heard a line this week that when under Bob Bradley, the scouting report before every match was around 5 pages. It's now up to about 30 pages. So that shows you kind of the attention to detail that's now going on, which just wasn't there before. And the players all seem to know what their responsibilities are, but. You know, he's injected a belief into the players again, and that comes with results. Obviously, if you're winning games, then you're going to have more confidence in your ability, and you're going to be a bit more positive in your approach. But you know, they're looking so much more confident on the ball. They look a different team without it, and that is all down to his coaching efforts. But it's, I think, what we saw on, and we've seen it gradually creep into. Into his personality, I guess, over the last few weeks. But like you said, after that Burnley winner, the Swans winner against Burnley, he just ran down the touchline, punching the air, you know, absolutely loving it. And then the full-time whistle, he just did a lap of the pitch, running and fist-pumping. And, you know, fans respond to that. Everybody was on their feet, really cheering and going for it. It's, you know... We loved Gary Monk, but we rarely saw that kind of emotion, open emotion from him when he was here. And the same goes, we never saw that kind of thing from Loudrup. We saw quite a bit of it from Brendan Rodgers, and I'm sure you were used to that kind of thing, I guess. But, you know, we've not really had managers in a while in quite some time who really show their emotions in that way. And, you know, it's not... always necessary, you know, managers don't have to show their passion like that, but it is nice, I think, when after a win like that, you see how much it means to a manager, and he's clearly loving life at the moment, and it is just incredible the impact he's had.
I think, you know, he's clearly aware of the other games that are going on at the weekend, even if he doesn't know the results, he knows what that 3 points means in terms of, you know, I'm sure even when he sat down, when the day he turns up at the job, he's got one eye on Burnley at home as one we've got to get the 3 points from. So, you know, the payoff, the controversial penalty, the fact that it is a last-minute win, and I think all that probably falls into him thinking to himself, you know, we must be thinking with 5 to go there, we've got to get 3 points from this. Because it no matter what was going to go on elsewhere, it meant that gaps were going to open up. He knows that, for instance, Sunderland are entertaining Manchester City the next day. He's got all the information at his fingertips there, so it's that makes sense to me. But the other one I wanted to mention to you, Gito, as well, before we let you go, is the other signing, Olsen, in the January window. You know, there's when we were talking under Bradley, one of the things that you were saying was that they just couldn't defend, but that also they didn't look like defenders. That was the other problem, that none of them really looked like defenders. Now, obviously, the managers had an impact there, but also, you know, since Olsen's come in there, the number of goals Swansea have conceded has been completely different.
Yeah, we're still probably conceding too many, but you know, it's considerably less than the fours and fives that we were regularly conceding under Bob Bradley, and Olsen's been a fantastic signing. We've known for a while that we badly need a new left back. Neil Taylor wasn't up to Premier League standard. You could see that he could do a decent job defensively, but at this level you need to attack, and he got nosebleeds whenever he crossed the halfway line. Olsen's the complete opposite. He always wants to get forward.
Tons of energy.
He is, and he's. He's been given quite a bit of freedom too, because when he goes forward, Tom Carroll is asked to sort of deputise as a left back. So Olsen doesn't really need to worry about tracking back either when he does go forward, because he knows he's got that little bit of cover there every single time. And that means then that he's getting into these fantastic advanced positions. He's crossing the ball brilliantly, and he's already got 2 goals, both of them pretty similar in the sense that they've both just slammed in at the near post against Leicester and then against Burnley. He's been a big, big difference. He just gives us that added threat on the wing, which we didn't have before, and gives opposition sides more to think about. And that's the one thing we didn't do under Bob Bradley, give the opposition enough to think about. We were an easy team to defend against, as well as an easy team to score against. But Olsen's helped solidify both, well, solidify one end of the pitch and then given us more weaponry, really, at the other end of the pitch. And in terms of improving the defence as well, Alfie Mawson is the one that takes a lot of the credit, because he's grown into a ridiculously good defender overnight, really. He's had to learn very quickly, but he's still young, and he looks like a younger version of Ashley Williams, which is what we really needed this season. Mm.
So it's 5 points clear now, 5 points safe ahead of a group of teams who just don't look as good as Swansea at the moment, let's face it. How confident are you now of staying up? Do you think it's done and dusted? Are there still a few concerns there?
It's not done and dusted, and we need to make sure that there's no complacency. There's still a job to do, but I think most neutrals, looking at the Swansea position at the moment, would say that we're one of the favourites to stay up out of those that little group at the bottom. Since January 1st, since the turn of 2017 then, if the Premier League had started then, the Swans would be in the top four, which shows you really the kind of form that we've been in. And if we can just sustain, half of that kind of form, then we'll be okay. We just need to keep doing what we're doing, don't get complacent, keep up the hard work, and hopefully, we can secure safety, dare I say it, with a few weeks to spare, which, when you consider where we were around about Christmas time, that would have been unthinkable, completely unthinkable.
Just on that, the form that you're in there, Gito, your next two are Hull away, Bournemouth away, and then after the international break, you're back, and it's Middlesbrough at home, and, if there's ever an opportunity there to put 7 points on the board across three games, that's, current form. They won't be easy games. Bournemouth's a difficult place to go. Hull have shown improvements. Middlesbrough will be fighting for absolutely everything by that point, and we're coming on to a Middlesbrough supporter in a minute, but, that's an opportunity to add five to the total, possibly add seven to the total. Those games at the minute, there's absolutely nothing to scare Swansea, is there?
No, you'd be hoping that by the start of April we'll have crossed that 30-point threshold, which would be a brilliant place to be going into April. And that's not taking anything for granted, because, like you said, Hull vastly improved under Marco Silva. Bournemouth somehow got a point against Man United, and we know what they can do in an attacking sense, even if they can't defend. And then you've got Middlesbrough, who, their problems scoring, but defensively they're always quite tough, and they're always difficult to play against, I think. So they're not easy games, but the Swans are going to be very confident going into each one of those games. They're going to be feeling like they're better than the other teams down the bottom, the way we're playing at the moment. Obviously, if we go on a 3-0 losing run, all of a sudden, things are turned around, and you're once again worrying. So again, that should be a warning against complacency. But there's no reason why we can't go into those games feeling that we can get wins.
Okay, Gito Llewellyn, always great to speak to him. As the part of the Jack Cast on Twitter, that's at the Jack Cast, all one word, spelt exactly as you'd expect on Twitter. You can find all the information that you want to from them there. Give them a follow and have a listen to the latest show at the minute. They must be absolutely buzzing. Someone who isn't is Dan Gray. We're going to chat to him now about Middlesbrough. And here is Dan. Dan. I mean, first and foremost, new book, Saturday 3 p.m, 50 Eternal Delights of Modern Football. I want to give that a shout. The reason why I want to give it a shout is because I think we might need to remind you of each of the 50 Eternal Delights of Modern Football at the moment, because Middlesbrough looks painful. I'm looking at both North East sides, I'll be honest with you, Dan. I'm going to lump you in with Sunderland. I'm looking at both North East sides, and I'm suddenly going, this looks really, really difficult for them.
Yeah, it's absolutely fair. I need to certainly reread my own material to be cheered and re-listen to my August self, because the August self's a different self to the man.
He was a lovely fella.
he was Will Self's brother, in fact, but less wordy.
Remember Championship Dan? What a fella he was.
Oh, Championship Dan was having a great time every week.
Championship Dan you'll hear from in August again. I think it's the Sunderland lumping in with is absolutely fair, which is terrible for both fine sets of supporters, really. But we've got to be favourites the way we're playing, and the lack of fight we're showing, whether it's they're not playing for the manager or what, they've got all the fight of Harold Bishop lapsing into quicksand at the moment, and it's just a horrible side to watch, really. I don't know, I can't really think put too much blame on too many of the players, because it's just the 11 changes every week.
Go on, John.
No, I was just going to say, the lack of goals thing's a massive problem, isn't it, as well? You're looking at other teams down there, and enough of them feel like, they've at least got a fella who can put it in the back of the net a little bit,
Yeah.
And it's just, you kind of, as soon as Stoke score one on Saturday, you sort of worry that's game over, and you can't really have that, can you?
There's such an obsession with the opposition, which has always been Karanka's way in terms of, well organised and all of that, but it's just tipped into, we don't play at all. There was an article last week about the 80-page dossiers he does about every side, and that sort of thing. I mean, I'm a Philistine anyway, and it takes the joy out of football for me, that kind of thing, but then who am I to see what goes on in the game?
Well, it's taken the joy out.
We're obsessed with the other team,
absolute,
that we don't play ourselves at all.
But you say that he's taking the job for you, but if he's taking the job for the players as well, then that becomes a huge worry. And players famously don't want to read 80-page stuff, you know what I mean? We've heard stories in the past, but it's hard enough get them to watch little videos and things like that. And
yeah.
if they're not enjoying going to work, then it does sort of become a bit of a problem, doesn't it?
It really does. I was down at the Palace the week before last, and joyless would be the word to describe them, and that. There's just a real rigidity about Karanka, which was a strength for a while, because that's what got us up after all, sticking to the system, being so well organised. But after the game this Saturday, after the Stoke game, when he said we didn't play 4-4-2 because the players don't know how, I mean, that's a bad way to speak about your players anyway, and patronising them. They'll all have grown up playing 4-4-2. It's just really strange scapegoating. At Crystal Palace, we played Downing left-back instead of putting James Husband in, who's a recognised left back. He's in the 25-man squad, so presumably he's deemed good enough to play. I'm just saying, he said it was because Husband's never faced anyone like Andros Townsend before. Well, no one's ever going to do anything if we go on that kind of logic.
Yeah, never play a youth player ever again.
It's two league goals, I think, now since the turn of the year, and that's when we were talking last season to you, let's go back to Championship Dan, one of the things that you were saying is that what Middlesbrough were doing very, very well was setting up very, very solidly and not letting the opposition sort of breathe. They didn't get a minute. The players are just simply less good. I wouldn't presume that there's not many sides in the league, for instance, who I would say will go to Stoke and definitely keep a clean sheet. Even Chelsea, when they've been at the best this season, they were still, they weren't conceding that many chances, but they were still conceding the odd goal. And the problem, I think, is last season it was, we've got slightly better players, we set up very, very solidly, we know we can keep the opposition out, and we'll find a way to get one, and then if we get one, then the game will open up and there'll be a second at some point. And it just doesn't seem like it's moved on from that, whereas, you contrast that with the way Bournemouth acted when they came up a couple of seasons back, and, that there was, Bournemouth have a very clear plan as to how they're going to take points, especially at home against a certain level of side, and they commit to that, whereas for Middlesbrough, that's what I'm looking at. I'm just looking at the side. They were trying to do what they're doing in the what they were doing in the Championship, it's building exactly it on that. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, even from you've called that right from afar, and the very fact that every team in the Premier League, as you say, has got someone who can do something special that doesn't exist in the Championship. But we've not at all moved on from that mentality, and now we need to really dig and score goals. Then it's so entrenched. What, in terms of what you do, is there any worse in losing a manager with 11 games left? I would suggest not really. And so we either rapidly change things or we just the thing that really hurts me is going down without a fight. You see the clubs all fighting, even Sunderland with the squad and sort of lack of morale there. There is a bit of fight about them, and you know they've got Jermaine Defoe to inspire them a bit, and it just doesn't feel like that. On the other hand, we're going to win the cup, so it's absolutely.
I will come on to the cup in a second. Just one more little thing on this is, you know, he doesn't play Negredo at the weekend, and he goes with Gestede instead, and I think that there's. Even in there, you know, he signed Negredo for a purpose. And when you're saying about him, you know, is there a purpose to getting rid of him at this stage of the season? I can completely see the argument of, well, we've come this far, there's only 11 games left, let's see. The question I'd ask is if there's the appetite, both amongst the supporter base, the manager himself, the players, and the Steve Gibson, who makes the ultimate decision, to keep him on into next season. If you do go down, because you can make the argument, well, this fella knows how to get us out of the Championship. But
yeah,
what I'm saying
to be honest with you, I would guess either way, stay up or go down, and it does look like go down. I would guess Carranco will go in the summer from the amount of it's all too infrequently unhappy times and stories of upset players and the way he freezes players. Bamford was signed for £6 million 2 months ago and has had, you know, less than half an hour in the league. It just suddenly, the way Jordan Rhodes just didn't get a look in, frozen out. He seems to, these fallings out, I think there's just been, there seem to have been too many of them. And I see Carranco going in the summer, whichever division we're in, really, from his own volition back, which is more likely. I could see him going back to Spain.
You've got him next weekend. You've got Manchester City in the cup, like you say, 3-2 against Oxford last time out, and George Dugdale often comes on and tells us that Oxford are the best team in the world. So that's a good result to score 3 against the mighty Oxford United. But Man City, it's an interesting game, one which I think could well end up being. There's every chance that you get a result, you find a way to dog it out against Manchester City. They look good at the minute, but you do wonder about their focus between the number of different things that they've got on their plate, and they've got another league game midweek before that one. It is actually an opportunity to do something. It's an opportunity to have fun. Are the Borough supporters enjoying this little mad cup run that's perked up at the sudden quarter-final place?
I mean, the crowds have been brilliant up to, you know, 28,000-30,000 in each round so far. We've had good home draws. It's just sort of, it almost feels like the cup run's crept up on us because of the distraction of the league, and I think it's fair to say that most of us would take winning the cup and being relegated rather than staying up and not winning the cup. Maybe I'm just too old-fashioned, but and so as for Saturday, well, I think we're so far apart from Man City that we just have to treat it like a proper old-school cup shock kind of atmosphere. It doesn't help that it's 12:15, because as you know, they're never as loud, those games. I think we'll scrap something or we'll get beat 7-0.
Maybe we want to start cutting the pitch up and stuff like that. Make it like that Hereford one.
Exactly. I think it's the only way.
Get a gang of lads down with some shovels on Thursday morning. I'm sure they could do some serious work.
Holes in the pitch bigger than Sarnie.
sorting all of that out. So, I mean, the last sort of thing to ask you, we've been speaking to a Swansea supporter and they turned it round, and, you know, it's not infeasible that suddenly from somewhere Middlesbrough find a path to 7 points. Who do you think looks vulnerable ahead of you? I mean, is the one in particular you're looking at thinking, is it just Palace now? Do you think that the rest are far enough away, or can you see Bournemouth getting sucked in as well, or do you just sort of think, well, the bottom three might just be the bottom three now?
That's probably, you know, it's Monday, we've lost again, so I'm going to say the bottom three feels like the bottom three, because I've never felt Palace would be down there at the end, really. It would be criminal if there were, given that they've got, you know, the relegation czar in charge and the squad they've got. You know, we'd be aiming for Swansea and that would be about it, but as you say, they're playing lovely football and the crowd seems to be back behind them. The last time we won was against Swansea, and after that match, I was speaking to a lot of Swansea fans in the pub after, and they were just, you know, they'd completely given up the whole season, and it just keeps coming back to me, that moment. We were quite buoyant looking upwards, and those twists on which a season turns, but, you know, I enjoy Huddersfield away anyway. Might come up, actually. That'll be rubbish,
won't it? You don't want to cross over on them. Anyway, always fantastic to speak to Dan. We mentioned the book again, Dan. Is it going well, by the way? Is it selling well? I'll be very pleased.
It's selling well for one of mine, so that's nice. Yeah.
So you're too niche in the past.
I know, exactly.
Going to crew
exactly
in there.
So I'm looking at getting a new shed, hopefully, when the royalties come through.
Excellent.
That's what it's all about.
Our book publishing past mine and John's is that the royalties take League forever. So don't get carried away.
Small and infrequent.
that's the way we got paid and continue to do so. Huge thank you to Dan, obviously. Thank you to Gito and to Sam. We've sandwiched happiness in between two bits of sadness and confusion this week on 50-50 Football, your first week with this new show. We'll be back with more looking ahead on Thursday to both the Premier League games and the sixth round of the FA Cup. The phone calls will be absolutely magic on that one. Really looking forward to getting stuck in and getting some quality Lincoln time for that. You didn't see that coming when we started the Premier League show, but that's the way in which it's going to go this weekend. Thanks again. Thanks to John. I've been Neil Atkinson. This has been 50-50 Football.